content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week we will be reading from the edition dated April 22nd, 2011. Our first main story in the Week magazine this week is entitled Obama's Long-Term Deficit Plan. What happened? President Obama set the stage for an epic ideological struggle with Republicans this week, laying out his own plan to cut $4 trillion from the federal deficit over the next 12 years with a mix of tax hikes and spending cuts. Under the president's plan, Medicare and defense spending will be trimmed and Bush-era cut tax cuts for Americans earning $250,000 and over will be scrapped. Obama also used his speech at George Washington University to tear into a budget blueprint released last week by Republican Representative Paul Ryan, which proposed $4 trillion in savings by privatizing Medicare and making major cuts in Medicaid for the poor, while cutting the top tax rate from 35 to 25%. There's nothing serious about a plan that claims to reduce the deficit by spending $1 trillion on tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, said Obama. Obama said he was open to negotiations with Republicans over details of his plan, but he insisted he would largely preserve Medicare and Medicaid in their current form, as a promise we make to each other in this society. House Speaker John Boehner criticized Obama for being late to address the debt issue and declared that reducing deficits by raising taxes is a non-starter with his party. Here's what the editorials had to say. At last, Obama is challenging the ridiculous Republican idea that tax cuts can shrink federal deficit, said the New York Times. Incredibly, the Ryan plan would slash $4.3 trillion from vital services while adding $4.2 trillion in debt through tax cuts. Our current debt crisis was largely caused by the trillions in tax cuts handed out by President George W. Bush, which turned the Clinton era budget surplus into a $1 trillion plus deficit. So if we really want to dig the country out of its hole, both the rich and the middle class will have to pay more. Americans are already taxed to the hilt, said the Washington Times. Obama's credibility is already slipping, and it will fall further now that the White House is falling back on the classic Democratic tax and spend line, and as the public registers its disapproval of the president's ideas in coming weeks, Obama will find it harder and harder to get away with pushing his big spending plans. Now, here's what the columnists had to say about all this. Once again, Obama has proved with this deficit reduction plan that he was born a moderate, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. His budget plan sensibly shies away from the eye-popping spending cuts in Ryan's proposal, but also embraces the need for deficit reduction. That leaves Obama alone in the political center as he woos the independent voters who will determine the outcome of the 2012 presidential election. Obama might be eager to portray himself as a pragmatic centrist, but it was a mistake to address the deficit problem now, said Jonathan Chait in the New Republic Online. The sanity of the Republican Party is at a nadir, and Obama has given it leverage to use the loony Ryan plan as a baseline for negotiation. Instead, he should have held back until after his re-election in 2012, when the GOP will be in a less insanely triumphal mood. I couldn't disagree more, said E.J. Dion in the WashingtonPost.com. After months of mixed signals about what he was willing to fight for, Obama finally drew a line in the sand on tax cuts for the wealthy and on carefully reducing Medicare and Medicaid costs without pushing them onto seniors and the poor. It's good to have Obama back on the field. Now that he showed us his hand, let the contest begin in earnest, said Michael Tanner in the NationalReview.com. Obama says he wants to reduce the debt, but he's also in favor of growing the size of government and boosting taxes. Ryan and Republicans want to reduce debt by creating a smaller government that leaves both more money and more responsibility in the hands of individuals. That is a debate worth having. The next major item from the Week magazine this week is entitled Faltering Resolve in Libya. What happened? Cracks appeared in the international coalition battling to oust Muammar al-Qaddafi this week as Libyan rebels, Britain, and France openly criticized the air campaign that NATO took over from the U.S. 2 weeks ago. With the Libyan civil war still locked in a bloody stalemate and rebels struggling to hold on to key coastal towns, French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé called NATO action insufficient and urged other allies to share the burden of bombing raids now being conducted almost solely by Britain and France. Rebels complained of poor NATO air cover and admitted they were hesitant to advance on loyalist forces after two friendly fire incidents last week in which 18 of their men were killed. NATO generals rejected the criticism, saying Qaddafi had adapted his tactics to blunt coalition air power by staging hit-and-run raids and hiding men and artillery among civilians. As the West squabbled over military strategy, Qaddafi accepted an African Union peace plan that called for an immediate ceasefire while allowing the Libyan dictator to remain in power. Rebels rejected any deal that would leave Qaddafi in charge. We will not negotiate with the blood of our martyrs, said Rebel National Council Chairman Mustafa Abdul Jahil. We will die with them or be victorious. Their only concession, said Rebel leader Salwa Bergagis, was that Qaddafi could leave Libya with some of his ill-gotten wealth. We have to open a door for him, said Bergagis. Now here's what the editorials had to say about this difficult situation. Libya is the only country where the Arab Revolution became a military struggle, said the London Guardian, and for this very reason it may be one of the places where the regime stays put. The rebels have proven totally inept as a fighting force, and as the conflict drags on and the death toll mounts, international opinion will sour on the war. All this points to an outcome with Qaddafi and his sons in place. That's why the rebels must start negotiating with Qaddafi as soon as possible, said the Toronto Star. The African Union peace deal was an unsteady first step toward a transition of power. But Qaddafi's willingness to negotiate may offer an opening for his eventual ouster. Opportunity knocks only so often. Rebel leaders should think twice before shrugging off the next peace initiative. And now here's what the columnist had to say. The rebels may have rejected the African deal, said Leslie Gelb in the DailyBeast.com, but NATO leaders would be dead wrong to dismiss it out of hand. Instead, they should draft a beefed-up counterproposal that demands that Qaddafi's forces pull back to their bases and mandates a UN mission to police the ceasefire. If the result is a partition of Libya with Qaddafi ruling one half and the rebels ruling the other, so what? That doesn't seem like a terrible outcome when compared to a never-ending civil war. Have you forgotten why we intervened in Libya? Asked Benny Avni in the New York Post. We entered this war to tell Mideasterners that we won't permit tyrants to massacre their peoples to stay in power. If Qaddafi even ends up controlling just Tripoli, the Arab Spring will be over. The message to rebels and tyrants alike will be oppression wins. It's disingenuous for everyone to blame NATO for the lack of progress, said Ann Applebaum in Slate.com. The alliance was dragged kicking and screaming into this conflict by Britain and France, with Washington's connivance. That's why most NATO states are refusing to fly missions. If Britain and France run out of planes, fuel, money, or enthusiasm, then it's over. Gaddafi knows this war is only going to get tougher for the West as time goes on, said Daniel Server in TheAtlantic.com. With each day, the chance of more friendly fire incidents and civilian casualties only increases, as does the risk of the coalition falling apart as Western enthusiasm wanes. That's why our best course of action is to offer the dictator an escape route. But we should stress that it stays open only if Gaddafi and his family take advantage of it, and they do so very soon. Now let's turn to the controversy of the week from The Week magazine. This is entitled Obama versus the GOP. Who won the shutdown showdown? The Tea Party just scored its first victory, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, after a dramatic standoff with Democrats over the 2011 federal budget. Republican House Speaker John Boehner last week struck an 11th-hour deal with the White House to cut the budget by $39 billion, the largest spending cut in recent memory. True, this was less than the $100 billion that the GOP's Tea Party freshmen were after, but it was the best deal Boehner could get them. It avoided a government shutdown, for which the GOP would likely have been blamed, and it earned them considerable political momentum for the far more significant looming battles over the debt ceiling and the long-term deficit reduction. This was a stinging defeat for Democrats, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Obama not only caved in to his enemy's narrative that government is what ails America, he promptly magnified the damage by praising Congress for enacting the largest annual spending cut in our history. Republicans and Democrats are now battling over divergent visions of the country's future, and Democrats are being led by a bland, timid guy who doesn't stand for anything in particular. That's really not true, said Greg Sargent in the WashingtonPost.com. Sensing victory, the GOP introduced a last-minute proposal to defund Planned Parenthood, National Public Radio, and Environmental Enforcement as part of the budget deal, but Obama and the Democrats would have none of it. This admirable moment showed the Democrats look strong when they fight and refuse to budge. But the fact of the matter is that the Tea Party's rise has shifted the center way over to the right. Obama now fears being portrayed as a big-spending liberal more than anything, and his advisors believe his best route to re-election is to acknowledge the need for more fiscal discipline. That's disappointing to his liberal base, said Howard Kurtz in TheDailyBeast.com, but the White House is thinking only of the independents and moderates whose votes will decide the next election. Obama's goal in this budget battle was not to win, but to look like the only grown-up on the playground, a reasonable pragmatist steering a middle course between unyielding partisans. The whole battle looked like junior high to me, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. The game of government shutdown chicken only came about because Democrats didn't have the guts to defend their spending priorities and pass a 2011 budget last year, just before the midterm elections. That was a gross dereliction of duty. Meanwhile, many Republicans were willing and even eager to jeopardize the nation's economic recovery by shutting down the government. It's terrifying that these self-absorbed, reckless children are our elected leaders and that they must now work together to solve the long-term budget crisis. It's not so dire as all that, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. In the end, a shutdown was only averted because both sides came to understand that a deadlock hurts everybody. Polling showed that the independent voters strongly opposed a government shutdown and wanted the two parties to reach an agreement. Democrats are now resigned to the fact of spending cuts in future years, while Republicans are starting to see the political benefits of moderation and compromise. Politicians who are paying attention to voters' reactions to their squabbles, in other words, may now feel more pressure to find their way to the middle. Now, Now let's turn to the lighter side of the news for a few minutes here, and let's look at the very popular article, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4, from The Week magazine. It was a good week this week for Leadfoots after Texas took steps toward raising the speed limit on some of the state's highways to 85 miles per hour, the highest in the U.S. It was a good week for hoarding gold after Scrooge McDuck topped Forbes' list of the wealthiest imaginary characters. The rich Disney duck's fortune, which is mostly in gold coins, soared 30% to an imaginary $44.1 billion. On the strength of rising oil prices, Jed Clampett of the Beverly Hillbillies placed fifth with $9.5 billion. It was a good week for birthers after a poll of Republican voters elevated real estate mogul Donald Trump to a first-place tie with Mike Huckabee on a list of possible 2012 presidential candidates. A gleeful Trump, who's been questioning President Obama's citizenship, said he'd run as an independent if he doesn't get the GOP nomination. And it was a bad week for Internet security after authorities arrested a 75-year-old woman who allegedly cutting off the Internet in Georgia. She allegedly cut the Internet off in Georgia and in neighboring Armenia, that's a country of Georgia, and in Central Asia when she tried to dig up fiber optic cable for scrap metal. "I have no idea what the Internet is," said a very shaken Ashton Shakarian. It was a bad week for Ryan James Stephen of Mason, Ohio, who was charged with a misdemeanor for barking and snarling at a police dog after telling police the dog started it. And it was a bad week for do-it-yourself repairs after a British woman tried to even out a chipped rim on an old Chinese vase by hitting it with a hammer. She later discovered that the vase was from the Qing dynasty and that her repair work had reduced its value to $326,000. And now let's turn to the People's section of the Week magazine, dated April 22, 2011. The first item is Why Robertson Broke Up the Band. "Robbie Robertson knows he made the right decision," said Stephen Roderick in Rolling Stone magazine. The singer and guitarist, 67 now, is still blamed for breaking up the band, the legendary rock group he formed with Levon Helm, Rick Danko, Garth Hudson, and Richard Manuel in the mid-1960s. Back in 1978, Robertson made the unilateral decision that after 16 years, the band should stop touring, leading to its eventual demise. Every member of the group, including Robertson, was struggling with drugs or alcohol or both, and they no longer got along. "Our musical ability was disappearing before my eyes," he says. "You're in a place and it's on fire and you say, I've got to get out of here." The concert film The Last Waltz, which documents the band's final show, reveals the members as emaciated, wan specters. Richard would say, "Listen, my hands are shaking. I need to have some medicine so my hands won't shake." Tragedy followed. Manuel hung himself in 1986. Danko died of heart failure in 1999. Robertson and Helm, who used to be the best of friends, have only spoken once since 1978. "Levon's always been pissed off at either the manager, the agent, or the lawyer," Robertson sighs. "When those guys weren't around, it was me." The next item from the People's section of the Week magazine is called The High Priestess of the Himalayas. "Elizabeth Hawley is the historian of the Himalayas," said Eric Hansen in Outside magazine. "From her home in Kathmandu, Nepal, the 87-year-old Hawley has been documenting every climbing expedition in the mountain range there since 1963, some 80,000 climbs. A world traveler, Hawley came to Kathmandu in 1957 and was hooked. She came back a year later to stay for a good taking a good job as a journalist for Reuters, Every day during climbing season, she gets up at dead 07 o'clock and sets to work contacting climbers through her network of outfitters and tourist officials. "I make sure I know what flight they're arriving on," she says. "If it's the Thai flight, which gets in at noon, then at 1:45 I'm on the telephone to their hotel to get an appointment for the next day." Hawley can provide a trove of information about the weather, the topography of every peak there, past climbing accidents, and record-setting climbs. Climbers have learned that she's remarkably accurate, which is also the more remarkable when you consider that the bird like Hawley has never actually ascended a mountain. "I like to sleep in a comfortable bed, eat hot food and a chair at a table," she says. "I don't like trekking at all." Our next item is entitled Fry's Life After Oprah. James Fry is still the most hated author in America, said Erica Wagner in the London Times. Fry, 41, will likely never live down being called a fake and a liar on TV by Oprah Winfrey back in 2006. It was about at that time that his celebrated nonfiction memoir, A Million Little Pieces, was discovered to be more novel than memoir, containing gross fabrications about his time recovering from drug addiction. Frey went from best-selling author to pariah overnight. "I was certainly exiled, I believe, from the literary community," he says. As bad as things were then, Frey went through something much tougher in 2008, when his newborn son Leo died of a rare spinal condition just 11 days after he was born. "I'll say that happening puts a lot of stuff into perspective," says Frey. "Is getting yelled at on TV that big a deal? Nah. No, that wasn't even that bad a day. You go to your own child's funeral, that's a very, very bad day." Lately, he's been drawing criticism for a new novel that portrays Jesus as a drug-using bisexual. "He couldn't care less. The Oprah debacle," he said, "freed me from a lot of expectations. Now I can do whatever I want. I want to be the guy who lives outside, who breaks all the rules." Now, from the Week magazine, let's turn to the section that is included in the weekly briefing, and this particular one is entitled The Power to Declare War. President Obama ordered the U.S. military to attack Libya without congressional approval. Was this legal? Who has the power to declare war? Congress does, according to the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, unambiguously states that Congress shall have power to declare war. The president is designated commander-in-chief with the authority to direct the military. James Madison declared the War Powers Clause to be the most important in the Constitution because history had shown that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and therefore must be tempered by a deliberative Congress. How many times has Congress declared war? Just five. Against England in 1812, Mexico in 1846, Spain in 1898, Germany and Austria-Hungary in 1917, and Japan and Germany as the start of World War II. The U.S., of course, has been involved in far more than five military conflicts over the past two centuries. In fact, presidents have ordered the military into action in global trouble spots more than 100 times. From the beginning, presidents have argued that they have authority to take military action to protect vital national interests, and that congressional approval is not required if that action isn't a full-fledged war. World War II represented the last time Congress formally declared war. Since then, the War Powers Clause of the Constitution has become a nullity, if not a quaint relic, wrote John Dean, a former counselor to Richard Nixon. How did that happen? During the Cold War, the definition of war changed. In 1947, as the Soviet threat and fear of a nuclear confrontation loomed large, the federal government created the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the National Security Council, and the CIA. Each of these reported to the president, greatly enlarging the executive branch's authority over national security. The tipping point came when communist-controlled North Korea invaded South Korea in 1950. President Truman wanted to go to war, but was unsure that Congress would go along, so he pushed the United Nations to act and then argued that the U.S. was bound under the U.N. treaty to join in the effort. During the ensuing debate, Truman said his power to start a war without congressional authorization had been repeatedly recognized by Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court. When asked for a specific court decision, he snapped, "I haven't got it with me just now." Was Truman telling the truth? No. Nonetheless, a new precedent was set. Since then, presidents have sent American forces into combat many times without a formal declaration of war. Rather than call such action war, the U.S. and other nations has come to favor euphemisms such as police action, operation, use of force, and in the case of President Obama's recent attack on Libya, kinetic military action. War, says Georgetown University professor Barry Carter, has become a very subjective concept. Did Congress ever fight back? It did. In 1973, with the undeclared Vietnam War dragging on into its eighth year, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution to prevent future Vietnams. This law authorized the president to respond with military action to a national emergency created by attack upon the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces. But if the conflict lasted more than 60 days, the law required the president to get congressional approval. A livid President Nixon vetoed the resolution, denouncing its proponents for knife-in-the-back disloyalty. But Congress overrode the veto. What was the effect of that law? Very little. Virtually every president since Nixon has found a way to evade, stretch, or ignore the War Powers Resolution. President Reagan's interventions in Lebanon and Grenada, President George H.W. Bush's invasion of Panama, and President Bill Clinton's interventions in Somalia and Bosnia all utilized very loose interpretations of the requirement of a national emergency. In deciding to use U.S. forces to set up a no-fly zone and a no-drive zone in Libya, President Obama said that if Libya fell into chaos, it could ignite wider instability in the Middle East, with dangerous consequences to the national security interests of the United States. Even some Democratic congressmen call this a violation of the law's intent, but talk of challenging Obama's authority quickly died down. So who really has the power to declare war? In practice, the president does. Legal scholars continue to debate the fine points of the Constitution and the War Powers Resolution, but as Harvard Law School professor Jack Goldsmith recently pointed out, constitutional practice carries far more legal weight than theoretical debate. Congress has never truly challenged a president's authority to unilaterally order military action. Therefore, that authority has hardened into precedent, whatever the founders' original intent. President George H.W. Bush captured the attitude of every modern president when he launched the first Gulf War, obtaining congressional approval only after the decision to attack had been made. "I didn't have to get permission from some old goat in Congress," Bush said, "to kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait." And now the footnote to the briefing this week is entitled Obama's Change of Heart. When he was running for president in 2007, former constitutional law professor Barack Obama said that President George W. Bush had no legal authority to launch the Iraq War. The president does not have power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not involve stopping an actual or imminent threat to the nation, Obama said. His views have apparently evolved since he was elected, given his decision last month to order an attack on Libya without congressional approval. Obama justified his about-face by claiming the assault on Muammar al-Qaddafi's forces wasn't a war but a humanitarian mission carried out to enforce a UN resolution. With that, Obama joined a select group of presidents, among them Jefferson, Lincoln, and Nixon, who came in as opponents of expanded executive power, but changed their tunes once ensconced in the White House. As historian Arthur Schlesinger has noted, power always looks more responsible from within than from without. And now let's turn to the best columns in the U.S. this week, according to the editors of The Week magazine. The first one is entitled, Why We Can't Abandon Nuclear Power, and it was written by Mark Linus in the Los Angeles Times. Japan's Fukushima disaster has provided an important lesson, said Mark Linus. The public's worst fears about nuclear power are wildly irrational. Hit by a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, a massive tsunami, and a total loss of power, Fukushima is in many ways a worst-case scenario for a nuclear plant. Yet the radiation released poses little danger to the general public. The radioactive water released into the sea thus far, for example, would provide a dose of only 0.6 millisieverts to someone who eats seafood harvested just 1 mile from the plant for 1 year. The average American is exposed to five times that just from natural background radiation. In the messy real world, turning away from nuclear power only increases our dependency on dirty fossil fuels, especially coal. And to environmentalists like me, that means more global warming. If the world rejects nuclear, we will wind up adding another full degree Celsius to the global warming, which would be disastrous on a global scale. So let's keep things in perspective. Nuclear energy is not entirely safe, but coal and other fossil fuels are far, far worse. The next column in The Week magazine this week is entitled, A Nuremberg for All Al-Qaeda Terrorists. William Shawcross in the New York Times writes this one. In seeking justice for the perpetrators of 9/11, said William Shawcross, let us not forget Nuremberg. At the end of World War II, the Nazis were tried before military tribunals at Nuremberg, and justice was delivered swiftly and fairly. Just as important, by making public reams of evidence, the trials provided us with an invaluable historical record of the Nazi defendants' genocidal crimes. By modeling the Guantanamo hearings on that earlier tribunal, we could develop a similar vital history of Al-Qaeda that will inform generations to come. So just as judges and prosecutors from all allied nations took part in the trials of 1945 and 46, countries with the jurisdictional claim against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, those who lost citizens of 9/11, should be invited to send military lawyers to Guantanamo. The trial should also be carried out in full view of the press, so that the whole world can bear witness to the proceedings. If our goal is to prove to the world that the U.S. is a just nation, Mohammed and his co-conspirators do not have to be tried in civilian courts. Military justice worked at Nuremberg, and it can work again today. And the final column here from this week, by Beck, We Knew Ye Too Well. And this is written by Howard Kurtz in the DailyBeast.com. What an appropriate way for Glenn Beck to mark his exit, said Howard Kurtz. Beck, who became a national lightning rod with his incendiary conspiracy theories on Fox News, announced last week that he is leaving the network when his contract is up later this year. And as if to remind everyone why even Fox chairman Roger Ailes has tired of Beck's scorched earth factually challenged approach, a disdainful Beck this week said that only hookers who get 400 abortions depend on Planned Parenthood. In his 2.5 years at Fox, Beck built big ratings with wild conspiracy theories and venomous partisanship. Among his greatest hits accused Barack Obama of having a deep-seated hatred of white people, demanding that the nation's first Muslim congressman, Keith Ellison, prove that you are not working with our enemies, and likening Reform Judaism to radical Islam. This bile made Beck rich and famous, but his ratings plunged this year as the novelty of his nuttiness wore thin. His final legacy was to prove that even in a country addicted to partisan extremism, there is such a thing as going too far. And you are listening to our reading of the Week magazine for April 22nd, 2011. And now we'll turn to the section entitled The Last Word. This week, the feature is specifically entitled The First Curl of Smoke. Searching for fires from a tower in a vast, isolated wilderness, says Philip Connors, is the best job on earth. Until about 15 years ago, I thought fire lookouts had gone the way of itinerant cowboys, small-time gold prospectors, and other icons of an older, wilder West. Then a friend of mine named Manna Jane asked for my mailing address. MJ said she'd soon have a lot of time to write letters. When spring exams were over, she'd be off to New Mexico to watch for fires. I was intrigued, and more than a little envious. MJ's letters did not disappoint. She was posted in the middle of the Gila National Forest, on the edge of the world's first designated wilderness, 130 miles north of the border with Mexico. On Loco Mountain, she said, not a single man-made light could be seen after dark. She lived in her lookout tower, a 12-by-12-foot room on stilts. The nearest grocery store was 5 miles by pack trail and 85 more by mountain road. The romance in those letters was almost unimaginable. One spring, she wrote to say, she was taking another summer gig in the Gila, this time at a different tower, 40 miles southeast of Loco Mountain. She knew I was busy, tied to a desk in New York, but suggested I take a vacation and come see the country for a few days at least. I needed no further urging. I'd already hustled too long and for no good purpose in the city, and when I finally looked out on that country with 24 mountain ranges I couldn't name, more mountains than a person could hope to explore on foot in a lifetime, I guess you could say I fell in love at first sight. And what a sight it was, a stretch of country larger than the state of Maryland, nearly 20,000 square miles of desert and forest, sky island mountain chains in 3 states and 2 countries. In the afternoons, when MJ sat in the tower keeping watch, I hiked through old-growth fir and massive groves of quaking aspen. I was unaware of it at the time, but those aspen had grown back in the scar of what was, for almost half a century, the biggest fire on record in the Southwest, the McKnight Fire of 1951, which burned 50,000 acres along the slopes of the Black Range. Around our own little bonfire under starlight, MJ told me she'd grown antsy in the lookout. She wanted to get out on a fire, inhale the smoke, feel the heat of the flames, and make some bigger money, overtime and hazard pay. Her boss was game, she said, if she could find him someone reliable to take over her fire watch. By the time I had to hike out and head home, I'd talked myself into her job. I knew almost nothing about being a lookout except what I'd read in books. But what I'd read seemed promising. It doesn't take much in the way of body and mind to be a lookout, Norman McLean had written. It's mostly soul. Since that first summer, I've returned each succeeding year to sit 10,000 feet above sea level and watch for smoke. Most days I can see 100 miles in all directions. On clear days, I can make out mountains 180 miles away. To the east stretches the valley of the Rio Grande, cradled by the desert, austere, forbidding, dotted with creosote shrubs, and home to a collection of horned and thorned species evolved to live in a land of scarce water. To the north and south along the Black Range, a line of peaks rises and falls in timbered waves. To the west, the Rio Members meanders out of the mountains, its lower valley verdant with grasses. Beyond it rise more mesas and mountains, the Diablos, the Jerkies, the Mogollons, a peaceable kingdom, a wilderness in good working order, and my job to sound the alarm if it burns. Between 5 and 15 times a year, I'm the first to see smoke. Having spent 8 summers in my little glass-walled perch now, I have an intimate acquaintance with the look and feel of the border highlands each week of each month from April through August. I've seen lunar eclipses and desert sandstorms and lightning that made my hair stand on end. I've seen fires burn so hot they made their own weather. I've watched deer and elk frolic in the meadow below me and pine trees explode in a blue ball of smoke. If there's a better job anywhere on the planet, I'd like to know what it is. On the last day of April, I hike in for the start of another tour, smelling along the way the sweet, dry scent of pine needles and sunlight. My dog, Alice, 50 yards ahead of me, both of us loafing along, finding our rhythm, no reason to rush on such a fine spring day, a beautiful morning in the Black Range for April, unusually calm. We're a mile up the trail from the saddle, just across a short ridge connecting two hills, when I see a globule of smoke curl out of a canyon bottom, a mile northeast and 1,000 feet below. Fire. The absence of an up-canyon haze of drift smoke indicates the fire has just popped up. The color and the shape of the smoke tell me still other things, so by the time I drop my pack and key up my radio, Alice looking at me curiously, her head cocked to one side, I'm pretty certain I'm the only person on Earth who can see it. My initial reaction to the sight of smoke remains unchanged over the years. It's always a major kick. I take a couple of minutes to regulate my breathing and douse my sizzling nerve ends in the cold water of government professionalism before I press the transmit button on the radio. Otherwise, I'd sound as if I were the thing on fire. If you threw 100 darts at a map in the Black Range, you'd be hard-pressed to hit a spot more conducive to an unwanted fire. Brushy fuels cover steep slopes at the confluence of three drainages, offering the fire ample combustibles and plenty of avenues to move. Fire has been ruthlessly suppressed in the surrounding country for 100 years, so fuel loads are very high. The rough terrain makes the area too dangerous to work with a helicopter, removing one tool from the suppression arsenal. The proximity of Embry, less than 2 miles east, adds private homes to the list of concerns. With firefighters coming from between 40 and 120 miles away, no smoke jumpers available in the southwest just yet, I arrive on the peak about the same time the first crew of 5 reaches the fire. An airplane observer is up and circling, talking to the crew on the air-to-ground frequency. From the tower, I'm just able to see the top of the smoke rising above a ridge. At a little past noon, the crew returns its verdict on the source of the fire, an abandoned campfire. Perhaps a couple of weekend turkey hunters broke camp hurriedly, confident a stone ring would hold their fire's embers in check. No such luck, not this time. In the weather we've had lately, warm and windy, following on a dry winter, a pit of ash over coals can smolder for a couple of days, heating the surrounding earth until the pine duff around the stone circle ignites. At 12:40, Tony, the incident commander, calls his size up into the dispatch. The fire is 10 to 12 acres now, burning in grass and pinyon Jupiter, smoldering and making isolated runs with flame lengths of 2 to 3 feet. Winds are light and variable, gusting to 7. Potential for spread is high. Tony requests a heavy tanker for slurry drops and a second hotshot crew in addition to the one already on order. After signing off with dispatch, Tony dials up his crew on one of the tactical channels. I've reset my radio to scan in order to eavesdrop. Jimbo's going to mark off the fire's origin with some flagging tape. Make sure you've got plenty of water. I've got reinforcements coming. We're going to need everybody to be heavy hitters on this one. By mid-afternoon, 70 pairs of boots are on the ground, 3 hotshot crews and 2 engine crews, working furiously with chainsaws, Pulaskis, shovels, and rakes to cut and dig a containment line down to mineral soil along the fire's flanks, denuding the land of all vegetation. The goal is to halt the fire spread by starving it of fuel, keeping it inside the line. The observer plane circles overhead, given the IC updates on the fire's behavior. Guided on its drops by another aircraft called a lead plane, the tanker makes runs with slurry over the ridge tops, hoping to hold the head of the fire in check long enough for the ground crews to bring their lines along both flanks. Every now and then, a stand of thick timber torches and a dark gray cloud of smoke rises into the sky. Around 4 o'clock, the fire crosses the main creek bottom and begins to burn up the other side. The IC admits to the observer plane that, despite their suppression efforts, they may not catch this one. "Don't know what to recommend to you," the spotter replies. "You're doing all the right things, but it's kind of a dog's breakfast down there." The IC calls me next. "We know each other well, Tony and I. He's my boss's second in command, has been on the Gila 5 years. No need to mince words. We both know the score. If the fire continues to the top of the ridge on the north, it will eventually find continuous brush and heavy timber for miles to the west, including all the way to the top of my peak." "Phil, have you got your safety zones planned out?" Tony asks. "I've got options. The meadow is big and open and mostly grass. There's also a little boulder field where the deer have munched away all the vegetation. And, of course, there's always the cistern. I could drop down in there and tread water for a couple hours if it came to that." "Well, we'd try to fly you out by chopper before then, but just think ahead a little for me. Safety's absolutely number one." "Copy that," I say. "Good luck down there." At 5:15 p.m., a second tanker arrives on the scene, and for a couple of hours, the two tankers trade off, working load and return out of Grant County Airport in staggered increments, dropping 3,000 gallons of retardant with each load. Designed to coat vegetation in moisture, the retardant contains 85% water, 10% sulfate-based ammonia fertilizer, and a small amount of iron oxide to color the mixture red so the pilots can see their handiwork. All radio communication on the fire is punctuated by the whine and roar of chainsaws in the background. As dusk begins to fall, the fire cools amid rising humidity, falling temperatures, lighter winds. This is the moment of truth. With one last desperate push, the separate crews tie their lines into their slurry barrier, and the fire's growth is halted at 25 acres. There will remain several days of mop-up and monitor duty, not to mention a long night of patrolling the line and cooling off hot spots on the edges. But the battle this time has been won. The IC thanks the tanker pilots for their work and cuts them loose. The observer plane bids farewell, turns back toward the fire base. "You've saved our bacon on this one," the spotter tells the tanker pilots. "That could have been 20,000 acres if things didn't go our way. Let's do it again sometime, but maybe not real soon." No injuries, no damage to property, no explaining to prying reporters why this one got away. All in all, the best possible outcome. At least from a public relations standpoint, the residents of Embry will sleep easy tonight. And once the crews are back in camp and bedded down around midnight, so will I. That article was from the book Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, by Philip Connors, and it's copyrighted in 2011. And now let's take a look at the health and science section from the Week magazine for this week. This particular item entitled New Hope for Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's disease strikes 1 in 8 Americans over age 65, but scientists still know little about its causes and have yet to develop an effective treatment. Now, two studies, the largest ever to examine the complex disease, have identified five genes linked to Alzheimer's onset, providing new insights into why the disease develops and clues on how to slow or block its progress. I've been in Alzheimer's genetics since 1985, and I would have to say this is the most exciting event that's happened yet. Lead author Gerald D. Schellenberg of the University of Pennsylvania tells USA Today. More than 100 scientists from the United States and Europe pooled data to analyze the genes of 11,000 dementia sufferers and 43,000 healthy individuals, an unprecedented sample size. They found that dementia was related to the presence of five newly discovered genes which affect cholesterol levels, the movement of fat inside cells, and inflammation. The presence of any one of the genes increases a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's by 10 to 15%. Figuring out how the 10 genes linked to the disease thus far affect the brain, researchers say, could lead to a new drug treatment within the next decade. We will have a long way to go still, said Cardiff University researcher Julie Williams, but the jigsaw is beginning to come together. And now from the Talking Points section of the Week magazine, here's an article entitled The Civil War: Why Did the South Secede? History is usually written by the victors, said Gregory Lamb in the Christian Science Monitor. But in the case of the U.S. Civil War, the losing side's perspective is still very much alive. This week marked the 150th anniversary of the beginning of that brutal and bloody conflict, when Confederate forces began firing on Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina. Across the South, the proposition that the Confederate states were fighting not to preserve slavery, but to defend the noble principle of states' rights, is still widely held, and may even be gaining currency with the rise of the anti-government Tea Party movement. Some Southern conservatives are trying to reframe the Civil War as a struggle against big government, said John Meacham in the Knoxville, Tennessee News Sentinel, with only tangential connections to slavery. On a topic of such magnitude, Americans cannot afford to indulge in a blinkered editing of our own history. Slavery was a monstrous evil, and the Civil War was fought because it had to be defeated. Slavery certainly played a role in the Southern Rebellion, said Jack Hunter in the Charleston, South Carolina City paper. But it is not fair to say, as many liberals and Northerners routinely do, that the men of the South were motivated to fight and die by simple racism. The vast majority of men who fought for the Confederacy did not own slaves. In their hearts, they were fighting for the same principles the American colonists fought for in 1776, political and economic freedom, the right to self-govern, and the right to defend their home turf against foreign armies. That's not what they said at that time, said Leonard Pitts, Jr. in the Miami Herald. South Carolina's official declaration of the causes of secession said the state was leaving the Union because the northern states had denounced as sinful the institution of slavery. Alexander Stevens, vice president of the Confederacy, said the South was fighting to defend the great truth that the Negro is not quite equal to the white man and that slavery is his natural and moral condition. Some Southerners today would prefer to spin grand romantic fables of a lost cause, of lofty principle. But the ugly truth is that Confederates were traitors who seceded from the Union to protect their property rights, property being defined as 4 million human beings. If that truth makes someone uncomfortable, good, it should. And here's another item entitled Bob Dylan, Did He Sell Out in China? Well, once again, the iconoclastic folk rock singer Bob Dylan has broken creative new ground, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. He may have set a new low for music superstars who sell out their integrity for money. To receive permission to perform his first-ever concerts in China last week, the raspy troubadour of the 60s Freedom Anthems agreed to submit a list of songs he planned to perform to the Chinese Ministry of Culture. Lo and behold, Dylan then failed to sing the subversive protest ballads that made him so famous, Blowing in the Wind and The Times They Are a-Changin'. At a time when China is engaged in the harshest crackdown on the free speech in a decade, Dylan simply sang his censored set, took his pile of communist cash, and left. 50 years ago, Dylan was the conscience of a generation, said Azar Nafisi in The New Republican, but age, fame, and power and wealth have weakened his moral compass. The result? A disappointing and hypocritical show. Dylan's performance may have seemed uncontroversial to an American audience, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com, but my friends in China viewed his playlist as anything but tame. Although he dropped the times they are changing, its lyrics about senators and congressmen make little sense in China. But he opened his Beijing and Shanghai concerts with the overtly Christian "Gonna Change My Way of Thinking," which includes the lines, "So much oppression, can't keep track of it no more." And during the Ballad of a Thin Man, he virtually snarled at the crowd, "But something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?" If China's censors try to gag Gillen, they fail to notice he sang lyrics as subversive as anything he has written. And now a few final shorter notes here as we begin to wrap up the program for this week. About 46% of rural counties in the U.S. lost population over the last decade, while metropolitan areas defined as cities and their suburbs grew by 10.8%. China is running out of room to bury the 9 million Chinese who die each year and is urging people to choose cremation and bury ashes at sea or under trees. Sarah Palin's daughter, Bristol, was paid $262,000 in 2009 by the Candies Foundation to help raise awareness about teen pregnancy. The nonprofit foundation, which took in $1.7 million in donations, gave a total of $35,000 to groups trying to lower teen pregnancy rates. The Boston Medical Group does not say so in the radio and newspaper ads it buys across the country, but its primary treatment for erectile dysfunction is a powerful mix of drugs a man must inject into his own penis with a syringe every time he wants to have sex. And about 27% of congressional press releases are devoted to taunting the other party. A Harvard researcher found that while most of the 64,000 press releases he studied claim credit for a success or stake out of position, more than one in four are devoted to such statements as, "The other party is not listening to the American people." And finally, our poll watch for this week. 48% of Americans say that the Civil War was mainly about states' rights, while 38% say it was mainly about slavery. And 56% of Americans say that no books should be banned completely, while 18% say there are books that should be banned. 26% of Americans on this particular subject are just not sure. And a final quote from a section called Wit and Wisdom in the Week magazine, "Laughter is the corrective force which prevents us from becoming cranks." And that is attributed to Henry Bergson, quoted in the Springfield, Illinois State Journal Register. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We certainly hope that you have enjoyed the program. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long, until next time.